Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 25th of May, these are our main stories. The Russian mercenary group Wagner announces its withdrawal from a key Ukrainian city. So what next? As China is accused of hacking critical infrastructure across the US, are other countries at risk? A court in Vietnam jails a noodle seller who made fun of one of the country's most powerful ministers. Also in this podcast.
Beyonce overnight has described her as her beloved queen and saying what an absolute inspiration she was to her. I think that is, when you look at the breadth of it, people adore Tina Turner.
The queen of rock and roll who inspired superstars and her fans. We look back at the life and talent of Tina Turner. But first, we start in Ukraine. And is it a question of mission accomplished or some kind of retreat? The Russian mercenary group Wagner says it's leaving its positions in the Ukrainian city of Bakhmut and handing them over to regular Russian troops. Its leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, made the announcement.
We are withdrawing units from Bakhmut. Today, it's the 25th of May. By the 1st of June, the main parts of the unit will be relocated at the rear camps. We are handing over our positions to the military. Ammunition, positions, everything, including food rations.
Moscow says the city is in Russian hands, but Kyiv insists that some pockets are still controlled by the Ukrainian army. I asked our Ukrainian analyst, Vitaly Shevchenko, if it was true that Wagner were withdrawing.
I have to sound a note of caution. Whenever we talk about Wagner and their leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, we have to remember that in the past he's been known to be economical with the truth. And when it comes to withdrawing from Bakhmut, he said earlier that he would be out of Bakhmut on the 10th of May. It didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Now he's saying that the withdrawal of his troops has started and they would be out of it by the 1st of June. However, he seemed to leave the door open for the possibility of some of his mercenaries staying there if the Russian official army really, really needs them.
How much fighting is there still in and around Bakhmut, considering it's such a key area?
It still appears to be happening. And in fact, the Ukrainian Deputy Defense Minister, Hanna Maляр, this morning said that Ukraine was still in control of a district on the southwestern edge of Bakhmut. She also said that Ukraine was trying to encircle Bakhmut along the flanks.
There's been a bit of a development on a story earlier this month about the drone attack on the Kremlin. US reports now saying they believe that Ukrainians were behind that and Russia has accused Ukraine of terrorism.
American media have published reports suggesting that US officials have picked up chatter among Ukrainian officials, blaming each other and parts of the Ukrainian security and military apparatus for this drone attack on the Kremlin on the 3rd of May. However, one thing that remains unclear is whether top Ukrainian officials knew about this attack, whether they authorized it. But the spokesman for Vladimir Putin, Dmitry Peskov, he said, "We knew from day one that it was Ukraine, so the Kremlin position remains that this was a terrorist attack, as they call it, targeting the Russian president."
And whereabouts are we at the moment with Ukraine talking about a spring offensive? Has there been any progress on that?
Ukrainian officials, they seem to be reluctant to divulge any details of when it's going to happen, if it's happening, and where exactly it might happen. A presidential advisor called Mykhailo Podolyak, he told an Italian broadcaster that this counteroffensive had been going on for days. To me, this situation appears to be less than clear.
That was Vitaly Shevchenko. A state-sponsored Chinese group has been accused of hacking into critical infrastructure networks across the US. According to the technology giant Microsoft, the group codenamed Vault Typhoon was looking at ways to disrupt critical communications between the US and Asia. Australia has also expressed concern about China. James Patterson is the Australian Shadow Minister for Cybersecurity.
These presences are often found on electricity networks, on telecommunication networks, on payment system networks, on water or gas grids. And the purpose to be on there is, there's only one purpose, which is to destabilise or shut them down in the event of a crisis. And the wider geopolitical or strategic purpose of that is to force a country to be inwardly focused rather than outwardly focused if there is to be a regional or global security crisis.
I've been speaking to our correspondent in Singapore, Nick Marsh.
Yeah, so this group, Charlotte, Vault Typhoon, was initially identified by Microsoft, now other Western intelligence agencies, including the National Security Agency in the US. And they say that Vault Typhoon is using this technique called living off the land. And I'm not going to get into the weeds of it all, but basically it's a method of accessing a system from the inside. So the malicious software blends in as a legitimate part of the program, so in this case, Microsoft Windows, and it stays there undetected. The US authorities are saying that from there, Vault Typhoon accessed all kinds of different civilian networks, like you had just heard from James Patterson there, so manufacturing, transport, tech, construction, and the whole point was to spy. And cybersecurity experts say it's not this kind of smash and grab attack we've seen in the past. It's about settling into a network, staying there, and then stealthily gathering information. Now, obviously, spying isn't new, but it's the scale and the difficulty of detecting this kind of spying. That's what's concerning the authorities. That's probably why they've gone public, because they don't always do that.
And apparently the US territory of Guam is one of the targets. And why might that be so?
Well, it's interesting that Microsoft referred to attempts to disrupt communications between the US and Asia, quote, in the event of future crises. And the most obvious type of crisis in this part of the world would be a conflict involving Taiwan. Now, obviously, we don't know what the US would do in that event, but Guam would be a key military hub for the Americans, the key military hub, probably. If you look on the map, it's this tiny dot in the Pacific. It's southeast of Taiwan, a couple of hours flight away. So it's strategic. And, you know, infiltrating that would be crucial for the Chinese if it ever got to that point. They've, of course, denied it in a recent news conference in the last hour or so.
Yeah, what have China been saying?
Well, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has just had its daily news conference in Beijing. A spokeswoman was asked about it. She said it was an unprofessional report. There's no proof. It's disinformation. And in fact, she turned it back on the US and said that the NSA is the world's largest hacking organization themselves. They tried to steal data, according to the Chinese, from a university in Xi'an in Shanxi province last year. It's the kind of response you'd expect from Beijing, to be honest. In reality, I think we know powerful countries spy on each other on both sides. Getting to the bottom of these individual cases, independently proving them, getting to the scale, that's a different question.
Nick Marsh. A man armed with a gun and a knife has killed three people, including two police officers, in central Japan. The authorities have surrounded a building in Nakano City where the attacker is believed to be holed up. Shaima Halil reports.
Footage from Japan's broadcaster NHK showed police officers and vehicles surrounding a residential area in Nakano City. The police received a distress call saying that a woman had been chased and stabbed by a man late afternoon local time. There were initial reports that a man dressed in army fatigues and carrying a shotgun fired at police officers who rushed to the scene. The authorities then said the perpetrator was on the run before hiding in a building which had been encircled by security. Speaking to NHK, a resident said people in the area were shocked that something like this had happened in their quiet neighborhood. The authorities have told residents to stay indoors.
Shaima Halil. Next, dubbed the Queen of Rock and Roll, Tina Turner was one of the biggest stars of her generation. She sold more than 180 million albums and won 12 Grammy Awards. Now the world of music is paying tribute to the icon, who's died at the age of 83. The Rolling Stones frontman Mick Jagger said Turner was inspiring, warm, funny and generous, while Gloria Gaynor said she paved the way for so many women in rock music, black and white. Fans around the world have also paid their respects, with flowers laid on her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in Los Angeles and outside her home in Küsnacht near Zurich in Switzerland. Here's one of her neighbours.
Slightly devastated. I mean, she's been a part of my life for over 35 years now, and she was a good neighbour. She showed up in town, she was very well liked, and yeah, it's sad she's gone now, but at age 83... I think it's okay to go. So yes, I'm just here to pay tribute.
She'll be remembered for the boundless energy she brought to her performances and that incredible voice. Our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson, has been telling me more about the tributes.
When I was a little girl.
Beyoncé overnight has described her as her beloved queen and saying what an absolute inspiration she was to her. I think that is, when you look at the breadth of it, people adore Tina Turner. And it's for the two reasons. Number one, her brilliance as a performer. The fact that she had seven decades of hits.
You must understand, the touch of your hand makes my pulse react.
She sort of retired when she was 60 around the turn of the millennium. She was still one of the biggest live draws in the world at that point. But people also adore Tina Turner because of her life story, that one that's been portrayed in the film and in the musical. This fact that she managed to escape from a 16-year abusive relationship with her husband, Ike Turner. She was in Dallas in 1976, ran off into the night in bare feet with 36 cents in her pocket, went to a hotel, begged her to put her up for the night, and from that moment, she tried to rebuild her life. At the end of the 70s, she was working as a cleaner, playing in hotels twice a night to try and earn enough money to survive. The record industry, not interested. Then two guys from Yorkshire in England came along. They'd been in the Human League. They were going to be in Heaven 17. Between times, they did a project called British Electric Foundation, and they got their heroes to record songs for a covers album. Tina did Ball of Confusion by The Temptations. That led to a one single deal with Capitol Records. That single was a cover of Let's Stay Together by Al Green. It went top 10 in the UK, so Capitol gave her 2 weeks to record an album to capitalise on the success. That album was Private Dancer.
I'm your private dancer, a dancer for money. Do what you want me to do.
And within 4 years, she played the biggest ever show by a female artist. 180,000 people in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. That is a comeback.
Out of the ruins. Out from the wreckage.
And I saw the musical. I was never lucky enough to see her live, but they talk a lot about how she essentially was written off. They said she's too old.
Yeah.
But she had her biggest hits when she was...
Mid-40s,
yeah.
Which is totally extraordinary. And then still at the age of 60, when she was doing her farewell tour, one of the biggest live draws. Just an example about how she would not take no for an answer. And that is why she is such an inspiration to so many people. Not just the enjoyment that she gives, but the fact just that she gives people hope.
And I wonder when we are ever gonna change.
And you met Tina Turner, didn't you?
Once. I was working for a very irreverent British TV show called The Big Breakfast back in 1999. I got one question to her. In Britain, her song, Simply the Best, is sung at a lot of football grounds. So I asked her, which team did she support? And she laughed and said, any team that wants to sing my song, I'm happy to give them support. Very diplomatic.
You're simply the best.
What a song, what a woman. That was Colin Patterson looking back at the life of the incredible Tina Turner. Let's go to Sierra Leone now, where an iconic landmark of the capital, Freetown, was brought down by a heavy storm last night. The towering cotton tree was hundreds of years old, and its disappearance immediately changed the face of the city. The journalist, Umara Fofana, has been talking about it with James Copnell.
It had actually been raining here, some heavy rainstorm about a week ago or so. One of the branches fell and people thought that was it and that the tree would survive. But then last night, amid the rainstorm, the entire tree caved in. The trunk and the trunk remains firmly rooted on the spot, though it's got to be said. But it is gone. The skyline in Freetown is changed, some say forever.
Yeah, because it really dominated the skyline, didn't it? Such a massive tree.
It was such a huge tropical tree of huge significance. Just about 100 meters away is the office of the president, and about 300 meters on the other side is what is known here as the Freedom Steps. So the freed slaves who are brought here from Nova Scotia walked up those steps, settled around under the cotton tree, offered prayers before going into mainland Freetown to use as their new home. And on the other side is what is now the Sierra Leone Post Office. That used to be the Court of Admiralty. So after the slave trade had been abolished by the British, all those rogue crews who were arrested were brought and tried in that building. So it's such a giant building, not just by its stature, but also its historical significance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just looking at President Julius Madabio's Twitter feed. He is saying it's a great loss to the nation and talking about a need to replace it, bring something to the same spot that bears testament to the great cotton tree's place in our history. Are there already suggestions about what could be done? Are we looking at a monument or plant another tree?
Well, we do not know. I would imagine that state officials will move there this morning to sort of like try to scratch their heads to know what happens next. Just a few meters away from the cotton tree also is the Sierra Leone National Museum. So definitely some people are saying that it could be of significance to keep at least some chunk of the tree in the museum. Or some people are offering on social media that some carving should be made of the tree and kept inside that museum. We don't know, but like I said, the trunk is firmly rooted and it is believed that the tree would, grow again. We don't know. Hopefully when the president visits there this morning, as I understand he will, we'll be able to determine what the next steps are going to be.
Is there a lot of sadness about this?
Oh, some people definitely are sad. Some have called it horrific. Some say it's pathetic. Some say it's really very sad. But others, when I was there last night, and I have to say hundreds of people thronged around the cotton tree, others were joking about it. Some say the roots at the bottom of the tree have been used for witchcraft. Witches have been going there and wizards keeping their stuff there. So it's good that it's gone. It's good riddance. And interestingly, it happened just a few weeks ago. A Christian leader here said that the cotton tree would fall. And he said that it had been a harbinger of witchcraft. So it depends on who you talk to. Some are mourning its disappearance and others are just celebrating it.
Umara Fofana talking to James Copnell. Coming up, pets or private jets? Which are worse for the environment?
Supposing you were to take 5 very short return flights, that would take you to the equivalent of owning 30 dogs. And if you took account of high altitude factors, it'd be more like 60 dogs.
We assess the claim made by the boss of a private jet company.
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
Fukushima, a new audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
The radiation is here. It's everywhere.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It was the last attempt by Cambodia's main opposition party to gain admission to the general election in July. But the Constitutional Council has dismissed the appeal by the Candlelight Party. It was disqualified because it couldn't produce its original party registration paperwork. So what does that mean for the election? I asked our Asia Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton, to tell me more about the Candlelight Party.
Well, the Candlelight Party are basically the sort of remaining opposition politicians who are either still in Cambodia, they haven't gone into exile, and they're not in prison. So they got together and basically revived a party that had been formed a few years ago, but had been a bit dormant, and they gathered together. Now, the Candlelight Party ran in local elections and did quite well last year. They got about 20% of the vote. So they were thinking that in the national elections that are scheduled for July, July, they would get around 30 to 40% of the vote because they're really the only opposition party in Cambodia at the moment.
10 other parties have been given approval for this election, but you're saying the Candlelight Party were the only ones that provided a real challenge.
Yeah, that's right. There's 10, actually there's around 18 kind of smaller parties, but yeah, the Candlelight Party is the only one that really forms an opposition. The other ones are have kind of ceded control to the government. Hun Sen, who is the leader of Cambodia, he's been in power for almost 40 years, and his ruling party, those smaller parties all kind of agree that the ruling party should stay in power. They only get about 1% of the vote in national elections. So the Candlelight Party and its predecessor, the National Rescue Party, are the only ones that have really ever given a challenge to Hun Sen. And so I think that's why they really faced opposition when they registered for these elections. They tried to put in their registration parties. Like other parties, they were told that maybe their registration wasn't quite up to scratch. Other parties were given time to fill in the gaps on their registration. The Candlelight Party was told out right that they couldn't run in the upcoming elections because they didn't have their original papers. They say they were seized in a police raid a few years ago. The police have them. And so they've just been stopped from running in elections altogether.
Celia Hatton, a noodle vendor in Vietnam who parodied one of the country's most powerful ministers, has been sentenced to 5.5 years in prison for anti-state propaganda. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports.
Vietnam's communist leaders generally shun the spotlight. So when the London-based restaurateur Salt Bae posted a video of himself feeding one of Vietnam's most powerful political figures with slices of gold-covered steak costing more than his official monthly salary, it caused an online scandal. The Minister for Public Security, Tô Lâm, was in the UK at the time for the COP26 climate summit and had just paid his respects at the tomb of Karl Marx in London. Bui Tôn Lam, a noodle seller in the city of Da Nang, then copied Salt Bae's famous salt-sprinkling gesture and posted a video of it, which went viral. The Vietnamese authorities arrested him last September, charging him with posting more than 40 videos, which it was claimed had undermined the confidence of the Vietnamese people in their leaders. He was denied access to a lawyer until this month and has only been allowed to see his wife and children once. He's been sentenced to 5.5 years in prison with an additional 4 years of probation. Vietnam is notoriously intolerant of dissent. It has one of the world's lowest rankings for freedom of expression. Human rights groups say there are currently at least 170 people in jail for expressing their views.
That was Jonathan Hett. Can the Taliban be persuaded to end their ban on women working for aid agencies in Afghanistan? The leadership is reportedly close to finalising guidelines on reversing the prohibition, but it has made and broken many promises in the past. While the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, is in Afghanistan, where he's in discussions with senior Taliban figures on the way forward.
Well, I'm confident that very many of them are very ready, but green light needs to come now from the supreme leader. That's why I went to Kandahar. I come back from Kandahar yesterday. That's where the supreme leader of the Taliban sits, from where also the bans on education and work originates. What we got there was, number one, an assurance that these guidelines that would enable us to work all over the country are soon being finalized. And the second and perhaps more important thing is that they said we can negotiate interim measures that can bring our female staff back fully to work. They keep talking about their traditional values, Afghan Islamic values. I keep saying we want to respect them, but we have values too. And one of them is gender equality. And we cannot yield on that one. So I say, let's sit down and get agreements here.
The Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland. A Jamaican-born airman who joined the RAF to protect Britain from Nazi Germany has been laid to rest at a ceremony in London. Flight Sergeant Peter Brown, who was part of a group of elite flyers dubbed the Pilots of the Caribbean, died in December, aged 96. He had no known relatives, but a public appeal on his behalf attracted a huge response. Our correspondent, Helena Wilkinson, reports from the ceremony.
Peter Brown's coffin was draped in a Union Jack flag. The medals awarded to him after the Second World War were placed on top. The veteran had trained as a wireless operator and air gunner, and he flew in Lancaster bombers. The church was packed. Senior RAF personnel attended, including Air Chief Marshal Sir Mike Wigston, who gave a reading. Friends, distant relatives and others from the Caribbean who've served in the forces in the UK were also there. Peter Brown was described as a quiet, modest man with an old-fashioned charm and a love of cricket, a man who gave up his freedom to serve this country in the Second World War.
Helena Wilkinson. Owning pet dogs is as bad for the environment as flying. That's what the boss of a private jet company is claiming. But is there any truth to that? David Lewis has been finding out.
It's a question, apparently, that aspiring environmentalists with very deep pockets should be asking themselves. Pet pooch or private plane? It seems like a no-brainer, but not so according to businessman Patrick Hanson. He told a conference in moneyed Monaco, a popular place for personal pets and jets, that owning a dog can be as damaging to the environment as taking his flights. This is him.
Three dogs' emissions equal one of our passengers' emissions. That doesn't mean that we don't have to try to reduce the CO2 emissions per passengers and even saying some don't do small flights. But I think it is important to put things in perspective rather than just do finger pointing to a certain type of clientele. I think everyone who makes these choices be realistic about what those choices mean.
So dog wind worse than tailwinds? Scientist Mike Berners-Lee says no. It was from his book about carbon footprinting that Mr. Hanson drew on for information. Speaking to the BBC, Berners-Lee said it was all in the numbers.
I think it's a misinterpretation of data he's taken from my book. Yes, I said in my book, the average dog has a carbon footprint of about 700 kilos, and he's saying that the average passenger on one of his private jets has a carbon footprint per flight of 2.1 tonnes, so that does make three dogs for a single one-way must be a very short flight, because that number sounds suspiciously low to me. Supposing you were to take five very short return flights, that would take you to the equivalent of owning 30 dogs. And if you took account of high altitude factors, it'd be more like 60 dogs.
The British university professor went on to describe private jets as an incredibly unjustifiable carbon luxury and much worse for the environment than commercial flights. In short, it seems unlikely the professor will be this businessman's best friend.
David Lewis. Now, let's end this podcast with the music legend Tina Turner. She was speaking to Oprah Winfrey back in 2013 when she was asked how she'd describe her legacy.
Endurance. You know, endurance. I endured hardship all the way. If we stay on course, we stay focused, never smoking, never drinking, never doing drugs. My legacy is that I stayed on course from the beginning to the end because I believed in something inside of me that told me that it can get better or you can make something better and that I want it better. So my legacy is a person that strived for wanting it better and got it. You can get emotional when you start to talk about that, to be able to get to this stage and say, even when it's time to leave and go to another planet, excited about that because I'm curious. I'm not excited about to die, but I don't regret it when it's time for me. I've done what I came here to do.
That was Tina Turner talking about Tina Turner. And I can't think of anything else better to do today than listen to some more of her incredible music. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, here's Jackie Leonard.
Some good news for anyone who wants a bit more positivity in their lives. The Happy Pod is going to be a regular thing, an upbeat little addition to the Global News podcast feed, featuring nothing but the uplifting, inspiring or amusing. The first in the new series will be on June the 10th. And if you want to get involved, send us audio of the thing that brings you joy. The usual address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk.
If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter, and the producers were Tracy Gordon and Andrew Ochieng. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm David Boris.
And I'm Frankie C.
And we are the hosts of the music podcast Everybody Sucks, exploring the struggles and triumphs of the journey from amateur to professional.
Our guests include a wide variety of music industry people, from hit songwriters to established artists to leading edge producers.
We begin each episode by hearing a piece of music from their earliest days, and then going along for the ride as they evolve from amateurs to the professionals they are today.
Check us out on all platforms, and remember,
Everybody Sucks.
Acast recommends.